Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.
Now it is time for The Last Word with Lawrence O'Donnell. Good evening, Lawrence.
Good evening, Rachel. And I watched attentively your report on the Irish fishermen who are now telling the Russian Navy, Vladimir Putin's Navy, to go play their games somewhere else. And the man quoted... The man quoted as saying, "We're not moving." He's the head of the Cork Fishermen's Association. His name is Patrick Murphy. And I don't think Vladimir Putin knows enough Murphys. I don't think he does. I grew up with a whole gang of Murphys in Dorchester. And Rachel, in my experience, when Murphys say we're not moving, Murphys do not move. They do not move.
I will tell you that we have been covering this story for a few days on the show. And yesterday we didn't do it on the show because all the breaking news about the Supreme Court and everything. We just had other stuff to do. Mm-hmm. But we actually worked on producing a segment for the show on it last night that didn't happen. And I think about half of the production staff of the Rachel Maddow Show is about ready to volunteer to go to Cork to go make sure the fishermen can get the word out about what they're doing, and also because everybody wants to meet these men.
Yeah, you know, and that point about the meeting they had with the Russian ambassador, where they come out and say, it's all fine, the Russian ambassador basically caved to our demands and said he'll stay away from our fishing grounds. And then Russia comes out and denies that. I suspect that the fishermen are right, and Vladimir Putin doesn't want the official word to be, we backed down. But next Thursday, we're going to see who was right.
And it's also just like, how is it that with these military exercises, which are clearly not disconnected from the threats about what's going on in Ukraine? Mm-hmm. There's a lot to say about that, the military exercises and the military menace that they are waging on the borders of Ukraine. But how is it that these fishermen are the ones who have to go to the embassy to go negotiate the terms of the war exercises? I mean, like, they're willing to do it because they want their prawn grounds open and they need to go fish for mackerel. But they shouldn't be the ones having to do literal diplomacy with the ambassador, with the Russians thinking they can yank their chains by reneging on the promises they made in these meetings. I mean, we ask a lot of our fishermen just to put fish on the table. But when it comes to asking them to, like, you know, avert World War III on our behalf, I think they deserve some backup.
Well, you know, I can imagine Irish government officials, Irish foreign ministers speaking to the Russian ambassador and trying to explain the Murphys to them and then eventually just giving up and just waving in, just bring on the Murphys, let them talk directly to this guy.
Yeah, see how it goes next week with your little exercises, guys. See how it goes.
Right.
Thanks, Lawrence.
Thank you, Rachel. Thank you. Well, we are going to see something that we have never seen before. This is the strangest development in the televised history of Supreme Court confirmation processes. We are going to see an audition for the United States Supreme Court, and that audition will be televised. It will be on television next week. On Tuesday, South Carolina federal judge Michelle Childs will testify at her Senate confirmation hearing for promotion by President Biden to the Washington, D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, the most important federal appeals court in the country. More Supreme Court justices come from that court than any other. President Biden nominated Judge Childs to the Circuit Court of Appeals in December, and as luck would have it, her confirmation hearing was scheduled before the sudden news yesterday that Justice Stephen Breyer will retire at the end of the Supreme Court's term in the early summer. Tuesday's hearing will be, in effect, a full dress rehearsal for the Supreme Court confirmation hearing of Judge Michelle Childs if President Obama nominates her to the Supreme Court at the end of February, which is the timetable that the president announced today for his big decision. The hearing will also show us what any other nominee the president might choose will be subjected to in the Senate Judiciary Committee. Judge Childs might be able to actually win the Supreme Court job next Tuesday by delivering a stellar performance in what will be her second confirmation hearing as a federal judge. The other person at the top of the White House list to replace Justice Breyer has already been through two Senate confirmations. First, as a district court judge nominated by President Obama, and last year as a nominee by President Biden for the Washington, D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, where Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson now serves. This is the same appeals court that President Biden has nominated Judge Childs to join. The list of black women who are fully qualified to be Supreme Court justices is very, very long. That long list includes lawyers and law professors and judges all over the country. But because the United States Senate is dysfunctional, extremely dysfunctional, the list of possible nominees who could be confirmed by a 50-50 Senate is perhaps the shortest list we've ever had. The Senate is no place for optimists. The Senate is for realists who know how to count votes, and there will be no more important vote count in the Senate in the first 2 years of the Biden presidency than the vote on President Biden's first Supreme Court nominee. At Justice Stephen Breyer's retirement announcement today, President Biden said this.
The person I will nominate will be someone with extraordinary qualifications, character, experience, and integrity. And that person will be the first black woman ever nominated to the United States Supreme Court. It's long overdue, in my view. I made that commitment during the campaign for president, and I will keep that commitment.
No president has ever known more about the Senate confirmation process than Joe Biden. Joe Biden used to run confirmation hearings for Supreme Court judges when he was chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee. White House Chief of Staff Ron Klain served as counsel to that committee and has guided Supreme Court nominees through the confirmation process. They are both Senate realists. They both want to eliminate risk of any kind, in the single most important choice Joe Biden will make since he took the oath of office as president. And the way to do that, the way to eliminate risk, is to choose someone who has already been confirmed by the Senate, preferably someone who has been confirmed by the current Senate. The only person on the White House list who fills that description is Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson, who won her Senate confirmation to the Circuit Court of Appeals last year with 53 votes, including three Republican votes, Lindsey Graham, Susan Collins, and Lisa Murkowski. Last night on this program, Congressman James Clyburn of South Carolina made a strong case for the confirmability of his favorite for the Supreme Court, South Carolina federal judge, Michelle Childs, especially after James Clyburn has successfully lobbied, apparently, both Republican South Carolina senators to support Judge Childs.
He's a big-time supporter of Michelle Childs. Lindsey supports her. Tim Scott supports her. I've had discussions with both of them. I would not have gone out as far as I did with her without talking to those two senators, and I've talked to them about Michelle. They respect her highly. She has tremendous bipartisan support. I've talked to judges all over this country, and they would say to me, she is the best.
Until relatively recently, you didn't have to be a very good vote counter when nominating Supreme Court justices. Unanimous votes in the Senate were not unusual. The single most conservative Supreme Court justice of the 20th century, Antonin Scalia, was confirmed by the Senate 98-0 in 1986. In those days, everyone on the Senate believed that the only reason to vote against a nominee for the Supreme Court was that the nominee was plainly unqualified to be a judge. Early in the 21st century, when Chuck Schumer was still a relatively junior member of the Senate, he publicly mused about the possibility, just the possibility, of voting against a Supreme Court nominee simply because he disagreed with the nominee's opinions. And that was considered heresy in the Senate when Chuck Schumer first mentioned it. Now, it is the norm in the Senate. The vote for Joe Biden's nominee for the Supreme Court is going to be a very, very close vote. And so, it is extremely unlikely Joe Biden will take the chance of nominating someone who has not been through the Senate confirmation process, like, for example, Judge Leandra Kruger of the California Supreme Court. There is no doubt about Judge Kruger's judicial brilliance and qualifications, having served as a Supreme Court clerk and as an acting deputy solicitor general in the Obama administration, but she has never felt the pressure of a Senate judiciary confirmation hearing for a federal judgeship. And we have already seen how much particular experience like that matters to Joe Biden. The reason I was always close to certain that candidate Joe Biden was going to choose Kamala Harris as his vice presidential nominee is because Kamala Harris had experience on the presidential campaign trail. I asked Joe Biden about that in Michigan the day before he won the Michigan primary.
In your experience, and I mean your lifetime of political experience and watching this choice made, a running mate, do you think that it's important that it be someone who actually has been tested on that presidential debate stage the way I assume Barack Obama thought it was very important that his vice presidential candidate had already been tested at that level as you were standing beside him on the debate stage?
I think that's a very important factor.
Very important factor. And we're going to leave it at that today?
Yes.
Okay.
By the way, there's a number of women as well who have been tested in other ways, not on the debate stage, but in their debates in their states and being national figures. So, but yes, I think that's an important factor.
That is the way Joe Biden thinks. Joe Biden knew how strong a vice presidential candidate Kamala Harris would be because he saw her tested on the presidential debate stage, just as Barack Obama saw Joe Biden tested on the presidential debate stage before choosing him as his vice presidential nominee. If we were back in the days of unanimous votes for Supreme Court justices, Joe Biden could have a much, much longer list of possible Supreme Court nominees than he probably does tonight. Joe Biden does not approach Supreme Court Senate confirmation hearings as an optimist. He approaches them as a realist. The only optimist in this story is the justice who is retiring from the Supreme Court. Today, Justice Breyer cited George Washington and Abraham Lincoln and the references they made to the Democratic government of the United States being an experiment, an ongoing experiment in self-government. Justice Breyer said that this is what he tells students about that experiment.
It's us, but it's you. It's that next generation and the one after that. My grandchildren and their children. They'll determine whether the experiment still works. And of course, I am an optimist and I'm pretty sure it will.
Leading off our discussion tonight is Melissa Murray, professor of law at New York University. She served as a law clerk for Judge Sonia Sotomayor on the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals. She is an MSNBC contributor. Also with us, Michelle Bratcher Goodwin, Chancellor's professor of law at the University of California, Irvine. She has submitted amicus briefs to the United States Supreme Court. And I would like to begin by saying that both of our guests would be on the very long list of qualified women for the United States Supreme Court tonight if this process wasn't so ruined by the current dysfunction of the United States Senate. And Professor Murray, let me begin with you. And I don't want to lock this discussion in to these Senate realist parameters that I just described for the audience. And I'd like to hear what you would consider and what you would want the president to be considering ideally, without worrying about what the vote count is, in who should be included in a fair consideration of who should be on the Supreme Court.
Well, I think in order to think about who should be nominated to fill this seat, you have to think about the fact that this is likely a court whose ideological fracture is not going to change with the addition of this new justice. Nevertheless, we will have a liberal wing of three justices that will be composed entirely of women, two of whom will be women of color. As the court faces some of its biggest challenges, the fallout from whatever they choose to do with Roe versus Wade this spring, the affirmative action case looking forward, I think what is needed is someone on the liberal wing who can join the other two in being forceful voices of dissent, because that's going to be the realistic goal going forward. They do not have enough to make a majority. It's unlikely that they will be able to persuade their conservative colleagues to join them. They will be in dissent. And the question is, can they write dissents for the ages, the kinds of dissents that eventually, in time, become majority opinions?
Professor Goodwin, if you could have a few minutes with the president, what would you tell him about what you would hope for in this choice?
Well, let's be clear. In this choice, we have the potential to have a justice on the court who is familiar with the African-American community deeply, intimately, who's committed to justice, who has equal temperament, someone who's committed to the rule of law, someone who's well-studied, reads law well. We haven't had, since Justice Thurgood Marshall on the court, someone who is very clearly able to articulate a case and commitment to issues that affect the African-American community who happens to be African-American. There are justices on the court who have been very clear in their compassion, in their commitment to civil liberties and civil rights and how they affect everyone, including African-Americans. But we haven't had a justice on the court since Justice Thurgood Marshall, who represents that in a way that is unapologetic, let us say.
Professor Murray, I want to go back to your time in law school, or perhaps even shortly thereafter, where you're looking at the United States Supreme Court, and there's no woman on that court who looks like you. What did that feel like, and what were your thoughts then about the prospects or how long we might wait before we would see a Black woman on the Supreme Court?
Let's be very clear about this, Lawrence. That was every day in law school, because during the time I went to law school, which was only about 20 years ago, there were very few African-American women professors in the ranks of the top law schools, or even in the ranks of all of the law schools. We are very much a small sorority. Professor Goodwin and I have known each other for years. That's how close this sorority is. Not being able to see yourself represented in the institutions that you occupy is really is difficult. To imagine yourself to be a law professor, but you have no models on which to mold yourself, that's incredibly difficult. But to see an institution like the Supreme Court, one that has such an important impact on the lives of so many, including women of color, to not see your own views represented there when some of the most important issues affecting you are decided, that, I think, is absolutely untenable in a democracy like ours.
Professor Goodwin, the same question. When you were in law school, every law student is thinking about the Supreme Court pretty much every day. You don't see anyone on that court, no woman on that court who looks like you. What was that like? And what was it like when you heard Joe Biden say during the presidential campaign that he would nominate a Black woman to the court?
Well, this has been a glaring absence in the Supreme Court And there's been a lot of vitriol in the last day or two about the possibility of naming a Black woman to the United States Supreme Court. And I would urge people not to be distracted by the hand-wringing and by some of that, which has even leaned into a bit of racism in terms of presumption and the inflammatory rhetoric that's been associated with it. But like Professor Murray, when I attended law school, there was one African-American woman on that law school faculty. When I began teaching at a law school, I was the only African-American on that faculty. On the second law school faculty that I taught on, there were two African-Americans who were on that faculty. And so we are still at a time in which we're following that long arc of justice that Dr. Martin Luther King talked about so long ago. We are getting there. But to just give you an example, when I was in law school 30 years ago, it was common that women were not referenced in cases and that the standard language was a reasonable man standard. In fact, it seemed to be a bit of a pushback, which some of us did, which was to say about what about a reasonable person or a reasonable woman? And that was seen as heresy because the tradition had simply been so normalized about men. And so this is a refreshing addition that we've heard over the last day or so. And I think that for many people, they'll be inspired by what this represents.
Professor Murray, what should we be looking for in next week's remarkable, under the circumstances, scheduled confirmation hearing for Judge Childs?
I think this is going to be, as you say, an audition. I think the Biden administration, as you have suggested, will be looking for someone who is easily confirmable. And so I think they're going to be looking for whether or not she makes it through this confirmation in good order. The D.C. Circuit is the court that is often talked about as the second most important court in the United States after the Supreme Court. Many of the current justices who are on the court right now came from the D.C. Circuit. But Judge Childs has a different educational background that would add much needed diversity to this court. She's a graduate of the University of South Florida and South Carolina's law school. And of course, most of the justices on the current court are graduates of Ivy League institutions, with one exception, Amy Coney Barrett. So not only would she add racial and gender diversity to the bench, she would add a diversity of that experience, and she would be a justice who would come almost directly from the district court with a short stint in between, perhaps at the circuit court.
Professor Goodwin, quickly before our break, how important is it that the president consider breaking this Harvard-Yale lock on the Supreme Court?
It's incredibly important because the Supreme Court justices are supposed to be able to deliberate in a way that's representative of all Americans. And most Americans do not attend Ivy League institutions. And it's a court that's been very narrow in terms of socioeconomic status, in terms of where the justices have been educated, and even in terms of their religious background. So we have to do a much better job at the Supreme Court, and I would also suggest at our lower court levels too. So it would be refreshing to see President Biden, as he has already done with some of his other picks, seek to diversify the courts. And I would say that also includes with experience, people who are not necessarily coming from a prosecutorial lens or having worked for large law firms representing businesses and corporations.
Professor Melissa Murray and Professor Michelle Bratcher Goodwin, thank you very much for joining us tonight. It looks like we'll be on this subject for a couple of months. So please keep your 10 p.m. slots available for us. We'd really like to hear from you some more. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. And coming up, the front runner for the next Supreme Court nomination has been very helpful to the January 6th committee's investigation, simply by following the law and the Constitution. Congressman Jamie Raskin, a member of that committee, joins us next.
Hey, this is Jeff Lewis from Radio Andy. Live and uncensored, catch me talking with my friends about my latest obsessions, relationship issues, and bodily ailments. With that kind of drama that seems to follow me, you never know what's going to happen.
You can listen to Jeff Lewis live at home or anywhere you are. Download the SiriusXM app for over 425 channels of ad-free music, sports, entertainment, and more. Subscribe now and get 3 months free. Offer details apply.
Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.
The January 6th committee investigating the insurrection at the Capitol obtained hundreds of pages of documents that Donald Trump tried to hide from the committee, thanks to a ruling by a three-judge panel of the Washington, D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals that included Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson, who tonight is at the top of the short list of possible candidates to replace Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer. Judge Jackson is the only candidate for the Supreme Court who has ruled on matters involving investigations of the Trump administration. Last year, Judge Jackson wrote the opinion that required White House counsel Don McGahn to testify to the House Judiciary Committee in overruling claims of executive privilege. In that case, Judge Jackson wrote, "Presidents are not kings. They do not have subjects bound by loyalty or blood whose destiny they are entitled to control." The unanimous Circuit Court opinion that allowed the January 6th committee to obtain the records of the Trump White House says former President Trump has provided no basis for this court to override President Biden's judgment and the agreement and accommodations worked out between the political branches over these documents. Both branches agree that there is a unique legislative need for these documents and that they are directly relevant to the committee's inquiry into an attack on the legislative branch and its constitutional role in the peaceful transfer of power. Joining us now is Democratic Congressman Jamie Raskin of Maryland. He is a member of the January 6th committee and served as the lead impeachment manager in the second impeachment trial of Donald Trump. He is the author of the new book, Unthinkable. And importantly for our purposes tonight, he is a professor of constitutional law. I don't know whether I should call you Congressman or Professor Raskin tonight, but I'm eager to get your reaction to where things stand tonight with Justice Breyer's formal announcement today, the president's promise to make a decision within the month of February and possibly on to Senate confirmation hearings at some point in March.
Well, good evening, Lawrence. Thanks for having me. It's definitely an exciting moment. It always is when we can put someone new on the Supreme Court. I would hope this process moves as quickly as the process did for Amy Coney Barrett when she was added to the Supreme Court. That was a matter of weeks for the whole thing to happen. So I'm hoping that we're not going to run into a whole sequence of roadblocks and obstruction from the GOP. In terms of the decision that you were just citing, of course, that being part of that decision hardly put Judge Jackson out on some kind of a legal limb or in the vanguard of legal consciousness. I mean, I think a dozen judges all decided that way. I think only Clarence Thomas has ended up on the other side with that. It's just so obvious when you have the Congress and the current president of the United States, the executive branch, weighing in to say there's no reason to invoke executive privilege, and all you've got is a former president who's trying to cover up his involvement in an insurrection, trying to stop it, and not even offering any kind of legal justification for that. So it was a good thing she did, and she's been a very strong judge, but I don't think that isolates her in any way, because she was part of that decision.
If she finds herself in a Supreme Court confirmation hearing, surely Senator Cruz will go after those particular opinions. But as you say, they are backed up with virtually unanimously by the Supreme Court.
Yeah, I mean, Justice Gorsuch and Justice Kavanaugh voted that way. I mean, it would have been an act of really radical right-wing judicial activism to concoct a compelling interest for Donald Trump when the majority found he didn't even advance any interest, much less a compelling one, that would override an agreement between the legislative and executive branches that there was no warrant for invocation of the executive privilege, which, of course, is an exceptional remedy anyway. I mean, the basic rule of our courts is that the sovereign gets the evidence that it wants. The rule of law depends on that. And of course, that, you know, that's why the January 6th committee has been winning all of these cases against the various coup plotters and insurrectionists who think that somehow Donald Trump can wave a magic wand the way he used to do and prevent them from having to testify before our committee.
At this point, do you have what you need from the courts? Has the January 6th committee been backed up by the courts adequately?
Well, the overwhelming number of witnesses have gotten the right idea from what the courts have done, and they are cooperating and testifying. Well, I'd say we have a couple of lingering problems. I mean, one is that there are some witnesses who have clearly material fact-based testimony that they need to render or turn over to us, who think that they can just invoke the Fifth Amendment promiscuously for everything. They can come in and answer 800 questions with the Fifth Amendment. I've never seen anything like it. That's not how the Fifth Amendment is to be used. The Fifth Amendment is only to be invoked when you believe that the response would be self-incriminating. But you can't simply say, I don't want to have anything to do with this investigation, even if it wouldn't incriminate you in any way. So that's one thing we need to clear up. And then the other, of course, is those witnesses who are just refusing even to show up or to be part of it. I mean, Steve Bannon is one of them. And so we have to use those mechanisms of criminal contempt and civil contempt to make it clear that everybody owes the sovereign his or her honest and truthful testimony. So we've gotten most of everything we wanted from the courts, but that's not to say that we're not going to end up going to the courts in specific cases to compel people to participate or else to advance a valid constitutional privilege and not a phony one.
Congressman Jamie Raskin, thank you very much for joining us tonight. We really appreciate it.
Pleasure is mine.
Thank you. And coming up, President Biden got huge economic news today, good news today, and the Affordable Care Act that he helped President Obama pass just had its best enrollment period ever. Economic advisor to President Biden, Jared Bernstein, joins us next.
Hey, it's Andy Cohen. Join me on Andy Cohen Live, where it's just you, me, and some of the world's biggest celebrities.
Paris Hilton.
Chelsea Handler.
Seth Rogen.
I love you, Miley. Thank you so much.
You can listen to Andy Cohen Live at home or anywhere you are. No car required. Download the SiriusXM app for over 425 channels of ad-free music, sports, entertainment, and more. Subscribe now and get 3 months free. Offer details apply.
Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.
The economic data has just been published to show that 2021, last year, was the strongest year for the U.S. economy since 1984. The U.S. economy grew at 6.9% annual rate by the end of 2021. This is significantly better than analysts' expectations. Prior to that, in a statement, President Biden claimed credit for the record economic growth, saying, "This is no accident. My economic strategy is creating good jobs for Americans, rebuilding our manufacturing, and strengthening our supply chains here at home to help make our companies more competitive." And joining us now is Jared Bernstein. He is a member of President Biden's Council of Economic Advisors. Thank you very much for joining us tonight. Really appreciate it. You have good news to share about the growth rate in the American economy. But as we know, the economy is more than one statistic. Is the growth rate, is the price of this growth rate inflation?
Well, not in the sense that this growth rate is adjusted for inflation. That is, we just achieved the strongest GDP growth in 2021 in almost 40 years, as you said in your introduction. And that's adjusting for inflation. That is a real growth rate. Now, also in the background of that fast GDP growth is one of the tightest labor markets this country has ever seen. Unemployment fell faster last year than it ever has on record. Those data go all the way back to 1948. Over 6 million jobs created. If I were sitting here talking to you a year ago, which, by the way, I probably was, we would have been looking at 800,000 claims on unemployment insurance. This morning, we learned that there's something around 260,000. So all of those kind of statistics, I say not just to flood you with numbers, but to make the connection between a strong growing economy on the GDP side with that growth reaching working families through an extremely tight labor market.
Who are the beneficiaries of this growth rate? Because it's one of those numbers where it's a big macro number, yeah. But some people could be out there saying, gee, I don't feel this at all.
Yeah, no, it's a great point. I mean, some people, you start talking about GDP, they reasonably say, well, wait a second, I don't eat GDP, I don't drive in GDP, I don't pay rent with GDP. And the fact is, again, the connection there that's so critical, Lawrence, is the tight job market, which disproportionately is providing its benefits to those in the bottom half. I just saw some new numbers today. If you look at the wage growth of people in the bottom half of the job market, their pay is actually growing faster than workers at the top. Now, that's obviously opposite to the way it's been in periods where job markets have been more slack, where they've been less tight. And the reason for that is that when job markets get as tight as they are now, I mean, we actually have about the highest number of job openings on record. In fact, more job openings than there even are unemployed people. When you get to that level of labor demand, workers have a lot more bargaining clout. And I have to tell you, that is at the core of Bidenomics. Strong bargaining clout, so we ensure that working people benefit from economic growth. Now, we also have inflation issues that we should get into. They're out there, too. But at the same time, against the backdrop of that inflation, is the fastest growing economy in 40 years and the tightest labor market in generations.
And what about the record enrollment for the Affordable Care Act? How does that affect workers and the economy?
Well, it really achieves one of the key goals of Biden-Harris administration, which is to ensure that healthcare is a right, not a privilege, and that is it is accessible and affordable. And that occurs through a record-breaking 14.5 million people who signed up for 2022 healthcare coverage through the marketplace exchanges of the Affordable Care Act. Now, that includes just under 6 million people who have newly gained coverage. So the uninsured rate actually fell over the past year from about 10 to about 9%. So these are critically important gains, again, for the folks who need them the most.
Jared Bernstein, thank you very much for joining us. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Thank you. And coming up, Caroline Randall Williams returns to The Last Word to discuss the historic choice President Biden is about to make in his first nomination to the United States Supreme Court. Caroline Randall Williams joins us next. Last night, South Carolina Congressman James Clyburn told us the story of how he had been urging candidate Joe Biden to publicly pledge to nominate a black woman to the Supreme Court. Some of the Biden campaign staff were opposed to the candidate making that announcement. They were opposed to it for tactical reasons. And finally, during a commercial break in the South Carolina presidential debate, right there on TV, James Clyburn told Joe Biden about the feelings of his most important focus group, his three daughters.
I shared with Joe Biden what I had been hearing from them and their friends. I talked to them a lot, and they were telling me that there was this undercurrent out there that had to do with the feeling that African-American women were not getting their just due from the Democratic Party. And one of the things they brought up to me was the Supreme Court.
And after that backstage conversation during a commercial break in the presidential debate, Joe Biden went back out on the debate stage and said this.
And we talked about the Supreme Court. I'm looking forward to making sure there's a black woman on the Supreme Court to make sure we, in fact, get every representation.
And the rest is on its way to becoming history. Joining us now is Caroline Randall Williams, poet, essayist, and educator. She is writer in residence at Vanderbilt University. Caroline, thank you very much for joining us tonight. And this TV drama called Supreme Court Confirmation, which in TV terms began on that debate stage in South Carolina, is about a much longer story than that, that has been with us for quite some time. And I've been eager this week to get your reflections on where we stand tonight in that larger story.
Well, thank you so much for having me, Lawrence. It's great to be back. This is terrifically personal for me on so many levels. And you hear James Clyburn speaks, first of all, you're staggered by his gravitas and his competence. And I feel this tremendous gratitude that he gave voice to this concern as Black women that we have, that we do feel. You are speaking to a young woman who is the great-granddaughter of a man called Avon Williams, whose sister, Norma Erica Williams, gave birth to a man that we are all familiar with called Thurgood Marshall. My grandfather and Thurgood Marshall were first cousins. My grandfather's first job as a young lawyer was working for his cousin, Thurgood. And I grew up thinking about that legacy from the vantage of coming up underneath family photos and portraits and thinking about why there's been such a space between what my relative was able to accomplish and then a repeat of that wonderful accomplishment. And I love that Joe Biden is a white man who followed a black man into the Oval Office. And then when he stepped into it on his own terms, he brought a black woman with him. And he has made good on those promises and those actions and that stance from the moment that he, you know, took the stage with Barack Obama. And I think that it's a moment of reckoning for this country to see if the one half can let the other half have the right thing and get the right thing done. Black women in America have been voting with the popular vote of America for the last five presidents. We've only gotten three of those five into the office, and that's an untenable yet another untenable three-fifths compromise, in my opinion. And I think that having a black woman represent the judiciary branch in the Supreme Court would be a fortification of my faith in democracy's capacity to heal itself, even after all of these radical ruptures that we've been witnessing over the last, you know, 5-6 years.
It's one of those moments that now that it comes, the first thing you can feel about it is, why did it take so long? And so there's something conflicted in the way we feel about this. Good that it's happening, but can it really be 2022 where we're sitting here watching this happen for the first time?
I mean, and my answer is sure it can. I think that the arc of history, it's slow. It does bend toward justice, but it's real slow. I mean, think about this, Lawrence. We still have never had a Black person hold either of the two highest offices in the land who had a Black mother. I mean, thinking about Black women in that condition, you know, being born in this country of a Black female body does not get you to the presidency or the vice presidency yet. And that's something that I still, as a Black woman, think about. But at the very least, we can think that it gets you into the Supreme Court. We can think that it gets you into the halls of the Senate and of Congress. We have a long, long way to go. And the work is hard and wild. And, you know, the Republicans, if they want to argue about how it's fraught to make this an identity politics question, well, they had three chances to pick a person of color from their side. And they placed three white judges on that court. And so, you know, the Democrats are going to do the right thing as usual and take the side of attempting to make the bodies that represent the American people look more like the scope, breadth, and depth of the American people.
Caroline Randall Williams, thank you very much for joining us as we begin what is this historic journey of covering this Senate confirmation. We really appreciate it.
Great to be here, Lawrence. Good night.
Thank you. Tonight's Last Word is next. Time for tonight's Last Word.
Justice Breyer's law clerks and his colleagues, as many of the press here know, describe him and his work ethic, his desire to learn more, his kindness to those around him, and his optimism for the promise of our country. And he has patiently sought common ground and built consensus, seeking to bring the court together. I think he's a model public servant in a time of great division in this country. Justice Breyer has been everything his country could have asked of him.
President Biden gets tonight's last word.
Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.